Hello, my friends. We have something a little bit different for you here today. I wanted to share a podcast that I really love and I think you'll enjoy too. Every single weekday, History Daily brings you the fascinating stories of what happened on this day in history. Whatever kind of history you're looking for, History Daily has it. Politics, science, sports, everything from fashion firsts to famous battles. Even if you think you know history, you'll find new things to fascinate and inspire you. The episodes are only 20 minutes long, so they're perfect for a quick commute. History Daily is a collaboration from award-winning podcasters Airship and Noisier. And host Lindsey Graham has been doing this for years on shows like American History Tellers and American Scandal, so you can trust him to take you on a fun, informative journey into some momentous events that shaped the world. Stick around right now to hear two episodes of History Daily that I personally picked for you, back to back. We just finished our season on slavery, so the first episode is on the uprising that led to freedom for the captives on the slave ship Amistad in the 19th century. The other is on the Roman siege of Masada, way back in the 1st century AD. I hope you enjoy them as much as I do, and be sure to subscribe to History Daily.
It's just after 3 a.m. on July 2nd, 1839, off the coast of Cuba. Plantation owner Pedro Montes shifts uncomfortably in his bunk aboard the slave ship La Amistad. The two-masted schooner doesn't belong to Pedro, but the cargo aboard does. A few days ago, Pedro and another plantation owner bought 53 enslaved Africans at auction in Havana. They then chartered La Amistad to transport the captives to their plantations in the east of the country. But Pedro isn't comfortable on ships, and right now he's tossing and turning in a vain attempt to fall asleep. Pedro stops fidgeting when he hears a noise, a dull thud from somewhere up on deck. After lying awake for the last three nights, Pedro has grown used to the sound of the ship, but this thud seems out of place. Pedro lies still a few seconds longer until he hears the noise again. Pedro climbs out of bed and heads up on deck to investigate. A salty breeze blows over him as he moves across the deck, looking for the source of the sound, but it's a cloudy night, and the ship is a patchwork of shadows. Suddenly, two men lunge out of the darkness. Pedro stares in shock. It's two of the slaves. They should be chained up below deck, but somehow they're free. Pedro looks for something to defend himself with, and he finds a sailor's knife left on top of a barrel. But Pedro is no fighter. He swings the knife ineffectually as the men rush him and knock him to the deck. As they hold him down, Pedro sees more figures moving through the shadows. And to his despair, Pedro realizes that La Amistad is no longer in the hands of the plantation owners. It's controlled by the men they've enslaved. The captives of La Amistad may have liberated themselves, but their struggle is far from over. They'll soon embark on a second battle for freedom inside an American courtroom. Only after 3 years of legal wrangling will their case come to an end and decide the fate of the 53 Africans who broke free from their chains and seized control of La Amistad on July 2nd, 1839. From Noisier and Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is History Daily. History is made every day. On this podcast, every day, we tell the true stories of the people and events that shaped our world. Today is July 2nd, 1839, the Amistad Uprising. It's February 1839 in the tropical rainforest of West Africa, 5 months before the rebellion aboard La Amistad. Shengbe Pie wipes the sweat from his forehead as he walks along a trail near his village. The usually busy route is today deserted, but Shengbe doesn't pause to wonder why. Instead, his mouth waters at the thought of dinner his wife will have ready for him, and he smiles as he imagines his three children running to greet him. Shengbe is so lost in thought that at first he doesn't spot the four men stepping out of the tree line ahead. By the time he does notice them, the men have blocked the path. It suddenly dawns on Shengbe that these newcomers are the reason why everyone else is missing or hiding. Africa has been plundered by slavers for hundreds of years, Most European nations have recently outlawed the transportation of new slaves across the Atlantic, but that hasn't stopped the trade. It's just driven it underground. Sugar and cotton plantation owners in North America have a seemingly endless demand for unskilled labor. So Africans are still being kidnapped, sold at auction, and forced to work by brutal overseers. Now Shengbei fears he's walked right into a slave trader's trap. He slows as he approaches the four men. None of them say a word, so Shengbei steps off the trail to pass them. He's ready to run as soon as he's clear, but he doesn't get the chance. The men move first, grabbing Shengbei's arms. Shengbei tries to pull away, but he's knocked to his knees. His arms are wrenched behind his back, and his wrists are bound with rope. The men heave Shengbei to his feet and then tell him to walk. He hesitates, knowing that the direction they've pointed takes him away from his village. But a hard shove between the shoulder blades sends Shengbei stumbling, away from his family and into captivity. After a long trek to the coast, Shengbei is put aboard a Portuguese slave ship bound for Havana, Cuba. He's not alone. Dozens of other enslaved men are crammed into the hold, chained to stop them from escaping. The unsanitary conditions mean that many of them don't survive the long voyage across the Atlantic, but Shengbei does. He's still alive when the ship docks in Havana, 2 months after it left Africa. Since importing new slaves is now illegal, Shengbei and the others are secretly transported to shore at night. Then they're hauled onto a platform and sold at public auction. Shengbei doesn't speak any Spanish, so he has no idea that he's being passed off as a Cuban-born slave to make the transaction seem legal. And according to forged documents, his name isn't Shengbei Pia, but Joseph Sinque. Shengbei is brought to a pair of plantation owners, and shortly after the auction, they commission a ship to transport their new purchases to their property in East Cuba. Soon, Shengbei finds himself back in chains on La Amistad, a ship carrying 48 other enslaved men, 3 girls, and 1 boy. During the long, empty hours at sea, Shengbei wonders what he's done to deserve this imprisonment. But after 3 days, he has a stroke of luck. He discovers a loose nail in the deck. Shengbei pries it out of the wood and uses it to pick the lock in the iron collar around his neck. Then, in the darkness of the early hours of July 2, 1839, Shengbei helps his fellow captives out of their chains too. They then sneak up onto deck, where they overpower the crew and seize control of La Amistad. 2 of the enslaved men are killed in the brief fighting, as are the ship's captain and cook. But Shengbei allows a second mate to live, as well as the 2 plantation owners, although it's now them who will spend the voyage in chains. Shengbei orders the second mate to chart a course back to Africa and freedom. The enslaved men celebrate as the ship moves into open ocean, but the second mate they spared has other plans. That night, he secretly changes the ship's course to head northwest, away from Africa and towards the United States. In 2 months' time, La Amistad will sight land, but Shengbei's mood will sour when he realizes it's not the homecoming he hoped for. Instead, Shengbei and the other men of La Amistad will soon be captives once again, and this time they won't just face a future in chains. They'll be threatened with execution. It's August 21st, 1839, off Long Island, New York, 6 weeks after the Amistad Uprising. Lieutenant Thomas Gedney stares out over the prow of the USS Washington as it edges past Culloden Point. Here, the waters of Long Island Sound merge with the Atlantic, and it's in this region that a suspicious vessel with an all-black crew has recently been sighted. As captain of the Washington, Lieutenant Gedney has orders to patrol the area and ensure that this mysterious ship isn't a pirate's vessel. As his ship rounds the point, Lieutenant Gedney spots the vessel in the distance. He lifts his telescope to his eye for a closer look. The ship is a 2-masted schooner, matching the description he's been given, so Lieutenant Gedney orders a change of course to intercept. When the Washington comes alongside its target, Lieutenant Gedney sees that its sailors on board are black and dressed in little more than rags. Sensing something is amiss, Lieutenant Gedney assembles an armed boarding party. The black sailors make no attempt to stop them coming aboard, but since they don't speak any English, they respond to Lieutenant Gedney's questions with confused expressions. This puzzling situation begins to make sense a few minutes later, when 2 white men emerge from below deck wearing chains. They push their way to Lieutenant Gedney, shouting that their ship has been overrun by rebellious slaves. The two men claim to be plantation owners who've been taken hostage. Lieutenant Gedney immediately has his crew arrest the supposed slaves and unshackle the white men. And soon after, he takes control of La Amistad and sails it to New Haven, Connecticut, where its black crew are taken into custody and charged with murder and piracy. The odds are stacked against the men. They don't speak English and have no understanding of the legal system. But the enslaved Africans are not entirely without allies in America. Over the past 10 years, the anti-slavery abolitionist movement has grown in northern states. Newspapers and societies have been established to campaign for the eradication of slavery in America. And now that a slave ship has landed on their shores, these abolitionist societies rush to help. They want to make sure that the men of La Amistad are freed rather than punished. Donations pour in for a legal fund, and abolitionist volunteers manage to find a sailor on a British vessel who speaks the same language as the enslaved men. Now, finally, the Africans are able to tell their side of the story. Speaking through this translator, Changbe Pie gives a first-hand account of everything that's happened since the day he was captured. He describes in detail the hardship and inhumane treatment he and the others were subjected to during their captivity. His heart-wrenching story is enough to convince the court, and 5 months after their arrest, a judge rules that the men must be returned home to Africa. But the verdict is a controversial one. America is fiercely divided over the issue of slavery. And under pressure from the slaveholding southern states, President Martin Van Buren requests that the judgment be appealed, and more than a year later, the case is heard in the United States Supreme Court. But Van Buren is not the only president to take an interest in the men of La Amistad. One of his predecessors, former President John Quincy Adams, follows the saga closely in the newspapers. Adams is himself an abolitionist, and he volunteers to represent the Africans in court. He's nearing his mid-70s and hasn't argued a case before a judge in more than 30 years, but the offer is still gratefully accepted. Then, when his time comes to speak, Adams argues that the captives were not legally slaves and should never have been transported across the Atlantic. That means they should be considered free men under the law, and they should not be held culpable for their actions in the uprising, which was a justifiable attempt to escape from illegal captivity. When both sides rest, no one is sure which way the court will rule. But the prospects of the men being found innocent gets an unexpected boost when one of the Supreme Court justices dies during an overnight recess. Since he was a slave owner, he was expected to be unsympathetic to the plight of the men of La Amistad. But as it turns out, the dead justice will have no effect on the verdict. On March 9, 1841, the Supreme Court will rule in favor of the men by 7-1. It's a decision that will confirm that they are free to go and that Changbe Pie and the other captives from La Amistad will finally get the chance to return home. It's November 25, 1841, in Washington, D.C., 8 months after the Supreme Court ruling that freed the men of La Amistad. Changbe Pie pauses at the foot of a gangway and takes a moment to look around Washington's docks. It's been almost 3 years since he was abducted in West Africa, but today he's finally setting sail for home. Following the Supreme Court judgment, abolitionists in America began a new round of fundraising, this time to pay for Changbe and his fellow captives from La Amistad to go back to Africa. But not everyone will get the chance. Of the 52 other slaves who were chained up with Changbe in the hold of La Amistad, only 34 are still alive. The others passed away on board the slave ship or in American custody. But today, Changbe is grateful to walk up the creaking plank and join his countrymen for the journey ahead. A small crowd has gathered to watch the Africans go, and cheers ring out over the water as the tie lines are cast off. They have a long voyage ahead of them, but at least this time they won't be in chains. Soon, the American abolitionists who helped free the men of La Amistad move on to new battles. Over the next two decades, slavery becomes an even more controversial issue in the United States. Congressmen come to literal blows over whether to allow slavery in new territories and states. The Fugitive Slave Law compels Americans to hunt down runaway slaves who escaped to the North, and the abolitionist John Brown leads his own bloody uprising in a failed attempt to end slavery by force. But it will take another 23 years and a vicious civil war before the 13th Amendment finally abolishes the cruel practice in all of the United States. By that time, Shengbei Pie will have disappeared. The ship carrying him and the other men of L'Amistad arrived in West Africa in January 1842. Soon afterwards, Shengbei trekked inland in search of his family, but no one knows if he ever reunited with his wife and children. Still, whatever Shengbei's fate, he faced it as a free man, a far cry from the unhappy months he spent fighting for his life and liberty after an uprising on L'Amistad on July 2, 1839. Next on History Daily, July 3, 2013, Egypt's first democratically elected president is ousted in a military coup. From Noiser and Airship, this is History Daily, hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Audio editing by Mohammed Shazib. Sound design by Matthew Filler. Music by Thrum. This episode is written and researched by Rob Scragg, edited by William Simpson. Managing producer Emily Burke. Executive producers are William Simpson for Airship and Pascal Hughes for Noiser.
Past Lives is a 100% independent production, and your support is what allows us to make this show. If you haven't already, please subscribe to our Patreon, linked in the description. It's only $7 a month, and you get access to tons of bonus content, like interviews with great scholars, Q&As with me, our book club, and much more.
It's the summer of 36 BCE inside the walls of a new fortress at Masada, a rocky plateau high above the Judean desert. King Herod, a large, bearded man in his mid-30s, strides around deep foundations that will one day support two great palaces overlooking the Dead Sea. Herod is flanked by Roman guards, there to protect him from the slaves carrying out the construction work. For the past 2 years, King Herod has been the ruler of Judea, a mountainous vassal state of the Roman Empire. But his position is not a birthright. Herod was appointed as king of the Jews by the Roman Senate. He's been tasked with keeping order over the Jewish people from Jerusalem, the capital of Judea, some 60 miles north of Masada. Herod has taken to his new position with a brutal glee, inflicting high taxes on his people and killing any who defied him. But his own actions have made Herod paranoid. Knowing how the people of Judea despise him, Herod has made plans to keep himself and his family safe. He's rebuilding an ancient mountaintop fortification at Masada and turning it into an impenetrable stronghold. The summer sun beats down on the king's head, and the wind whips across the open plateau. As Herod watches his people work, an enslaved man dares to glance up at the king. At once, one of the guards removes a whip from his belt and cracks it across the man's shoulders. The struck slave falls to his knees in agony. A child, barely 10, runs up to comfort him. It's the enslaved man's son, who glares at Herod with undisguised hatred. Herod smiles and nods to the guard to whip the man again. But before the order can be carried out, the little boy flies at the king and starts beating his fists against Herod's legs. The boy's swings break like waves against a mighty cliff. Herod turns to his guards and laughs. Then he picks the boy up off the ground, watching as his small arms and legs flail. With giant strides, Herod walks toward the edge of the plateau with the child held aloft. The faces of the other enslaved people fall into anguish as they realize what's about to happen. The king hoists the boy above his shoulders and flings him over the edge of the cliff. Herod doesn't watch the child fall. He simply turns and walks away, sure that he's taught his people an important lesson in obedience. Over the next 3 years, King Herod will use slave labor to build two fortified palaces at Masada. By the time construction is complete, the fortress will house a swimming pool, barracks, and enough food for his family and a small band of soldiers to survive a siege for years if necessary. But despite his paranoia, King Herod will never face a direct assault by his own people. He will die an old man in the year 4 CE. But long after his death, there will be an uprising with Masada at its center. And although Herod designed it to be impenetrable, the fortress will eventually fall on April 16, 73 CE. From Noiser and Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is History Daily. History is made every day. On this podcast, every day, we tell the true stories of the people and events that shaped our world. Today is April 16th, 73 CE, the fall of the fortress of Massana. It's the spring of 67 CE in the Judean town of Yodvat, nearly a century after King Herod finished building his fortress. Hundreds of miles north of Massana, a 30-year-old Jewish priest named Yosef ben Matityahu cowers inside the catacombs of a rocky hilltop town. There are dozens of other young men beside him, their bodies weak with hunger and eyes wide with fear. They can hear the sound of fighting in the streets of the town above them, the clash of metal on metal, the screams of dying citizens, and the roar of the town on fire. Yodvat's defiance of the Roman Empire is coming to a bloody end. The region has been dominated by the Romans for over 100 years. Following the death of King Herod in 4 CE, Judea was brought under the direct control of Rome. For the most part, the local religion Judaism was allowed to continue with little interference. The Romans themselves worshipped many gods, after all, and tolerating local religious customs has helped them keep the peace in their vast empire. So while many of the Jewish people wished for independence from Rome, for decades there was little in the way of outright resistance. But this all changed in 66 CE. Discontent had been growing for some time over the taxes Jews were asked to pay Rome. But the flashpoint came when a group of Greek merchants blocked the entrance to the sacred Jewish Second Temple. The Romans did nothing to remove the merchants, and a wave of violence broke out across Jerusalem as a result. When Roman troops were deployed to restore order, their heavy-handed response turned a riot into a rebellion. The Jewish people were no longer willing to sit back and be ruled, and so began the First Jewish-Roman War. At first, the Jewish rebels inflicted heavy defeats on the Roman forces in Judea and seizing control of towns and cities across the province. But the Romans were never going to allow such defiance. Four legions under the command of General Vespasian were dispatched to crush the Jewish rebellion and restore Roman rule in the region. The Romans soon lay siege to the town of Yodvat. The Jewish stronghold has now held out for almost 50 days, but the Romans have finally broken through the defenses, and in the damp catacombs beneath the town, some of the final Jewish fighters must decide what they will do next. As water drips off the cave roof, the men know that their defiance is coming to an end. One emaciated soldier turns to Yosef and tells him he would rather die than be returned to Roman bondage. As a man of faith, Yosef doesn't believe in taking one's own life, even if it means avoiding slavery. So as another man suggests, they take out their swords and slay each other one by one. Yosef says nothing. The soldiers draw lots to decide who should die first, and then it begins. In the catacombs of Yodvat, 40 men end each other's lives at once until Yosef is the last man standing. Now he's left with a decision to make. He can follow the other men into death or live to see another sunrise. Yosef looks down at the lifeless bodies lying on the cave floor, and fear grips him. He can't do it. He decides that any life is better than death, so he walks out into the city and surrenders to the Romans. Yosef is a prominent figure in Judea, and following his surrender is granted an audience with the Roman general Vespasian. Bowing before him, Yosef knows that the only thing that can save his life now is flattery. He tells Vespasian that God came to him in a vision and told him that Vespasian and his son will one day lead Rome. Happy to hear this prophecy, Vespasian spares Yosef's life. The Jewish leader is imprisoned for 2 years until his prophecy comes true. In 69 CE, the Roman general Vespasian becomes Roman Emperor Vespasian. Believing that Yosef is a prophet, the new emperor orders his release. In the years that follow, Yosef ben Matityahu turns from Jewish rebel to Roman insider. He will change his name from the Jewish Yosef to the Roman Josephus. And from this new vantage point, Josephus will go on to write several history books, The most famous of these will be an account of another final stand by Jewish fighters, one that will take place 3 years after the fall of Yodfat at the mountain fortress of Masada. It's the spring of 70 CE at the fortress of Masada, 3 years after Yosef ben Matanyahu handed himself over to the Romans. From the walls of the citadel, a Jewish rebel general named Eleazar ben Yair squints against the bright desert sun. Peering down over the steep cliffs that surround the fortress, he can see a large group of people marching across the rocky landscape far below. A storm of dust is kicked up in their wake, and from this distance and height, Eleazar can't tell if the group is friend or foe. But he doesn't want to wait to find out. So sounding the alarm, he gathers up his best men and rides south on a reconnaissance mission. Taking Masada from the Romans was not easy, and Eleazar is unwilling to give up his fortress without a fight. Eleazar's fighters call themselves the Sicarii. Considered by many to be the most violent and dangerous of all the Jewish rebels, the Sicarii are named after the curved Sicca daggers they conceal beneath their cloaks. They're known to carry out assassinations of high-level Roman figures, but also kill any fellow Jews they believe are colluding with Roman forces. 3 years earlier, at the outset of the war, Eleazar ben Yair led his men up to the summit of Masada. Under the cover of darkness, Eleazar and his men slit the throats of the Roman soldiers stationed in the fortress. Then they set up base behind the great walls, plotting ways to rid Judea of the hated Romans. By now, though, the Jewish revolt is collapsing in the face of a brutal Roman counteroffensive. Galilee has fallen, as has the town of Yodfat. Eleazar knows that the Romans won't allow Masada to remain in the hands of the Jews either. 60,000 legionaries have been sent to restore Roman rule, and as Eleazar leads his own small scouting force down the mountain slope, he wonders whether the enemy has finally come for them. Crossing the rocky plain, though, Eleazar soon sees that it's not a troop of soldiers marching on Masada. Instead, it's a ragged column of hundreds of refugees, Jewish men, women, and children fleeing the Judean capital of Jerusalem. Through tears and curses, they tell Eleazar that the Romans have sacked Jerusalem, destroyed the sacred Second Temple, and ejected all Jews from the city's walls. Some of the refugees are battle-scarred, most are traumatized, and all are exhausted. With the help of his men, Eleazar gathers the refugees and begins the trek back towards Masada. But there's no time to rest. Eleazar is sure the Romans will be coming soon. Still, once he brings the refugees back to the high fortress of Masada, Eleazar feels confident and secure. He knows that old King Herod built the walls of Masada to withstand any attack. Herod was always fearful that one day there would be an uprising against him and designed this great fortress to be impregnable. He just never imagined that it would be his Roman allies that would one day be the ones to lay siege. And indeed, even with thousands of men, taking Masada will not be easy. There is only one way to reach the fortress, a snaking path up the mountainside that's barely wide enough for two people to walk side by side. The Romans' usual tactics of moving relentlessly forward in tight formations will be impossible here. It will take all the might and ingenuity of the Roman army to win a victory. But back in Rome, the new emperor is not discouraged. It was Vespasian's military prowess that helped him seize the imperial throne. And now that he is the ruler of the Roman Empire, he's eager to demonstrate that there is no corner of the world where Rome's enemies can hide. He wants to bring the Jewish revolt to a decisive end, so he orders his generals to march on Masada and take it back. Within days, a force of 5,000 Roman troops have assembled at the Judean capital of Jerusalem and is ready to move out. But their task will not be a simple one. Inside the well-supplied mountain fortress are almost 1,000 people ready to fight and stand their ground to the very last man, meaning the siege of Masada will drag on for 3 years. None of the rebels will survive. But their story of defiance and sacrifice against the greatest empire in the ancient world will become legendary. It's April 16th, 73 CE, at Masada in Judea, 3 years into the siege of the mountain fortress. deep within the citadel, Jewish General Eleazar ben Yair can hear the pounding of a mighty battering ram. The noise shakes the very foundations of the fortress. Dust and tiny rocks fall onto Eleazar's head and shoulders, and beside him, his soldiers anxiously wait for their next instruction. As Eleazar thinks, a thunderous, rumbling sound announces that the outer walls have finally given in. The high ground the Jewish rebels once held is no more. The Romans have built huge mud ramps up the side of the mountain, enabling them to deploy an enormous battering ram against the outer walls of the fortress. Those efforts have paid off. Now Roman troops have brought the walls down and are forcing their way into the fortress. The Jewish defenders light fires to slow down the Roman attack and fight for every inch of ground, but it's hopeless. As smoke fills the citadel, Eleazar orders any remaining survivors into the main temple in the middle of the fortress. No one can say for certain what happens behind those closed doors. After Eleazar orders his people to shut themselves inside the temple, their story passes into the realm of legend. One of the most famous accounts will come from Josephus, the Jewish priest turned soldier turned Roman historian. In his version of the story, the Romans breached the walls of the temple to find nothing but bodies inside. According to Josephus, in the last moments of the siege, Eleazar speaks powerfully to his followers, telling them that he would rather die by his own hand than be killed by Romans or live as slaves. This story is clearly inspired by the experience of Josephus and the catacombs of Yodfat. But while Josephus himself could not go through with a similar pact, Eleazar and his men keep their promise and all take their own lives. Little archaeological evidence will ever be found to support Josephus's account of mass suicide. Still, the ruins of the fortress will evolve into a site of pilgrimage for some, and the phrase "Masada shall not fall again" will become a rallying cry against anti-Semitism. The bravery and defiance of the defenders of Masada will remain legendary in Jewish history, even centuries after the fortress fell on April 16, 73 CE. Next on History Daily, April 17, 1942, a French army general escapes German captivity for the second time. From Noiser and Airship, this is History Daily, hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Audio editing by Mohamed Shazi. Sound design by Gabriel Gould. Music by Throne. This episode is written and researched by Owen Paul Nichols. Edited by Joel Callan. Managing producer, Emily Berg. Executive producers are William Simpson for Airship and Pascal Hughes for Noiser.
Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. The music and sound design is by Gabriel Gould. Thanks so much for joining me. Until next time, this has been Past Lives.